Begler versus McBride. Mr. Westerfield.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. I would like to discuss Marvin Bigler's claim that his 14th Amendment rights under Doyle versus Ohio were violated during his capital trial, and that prosecutors' unconstitutional comments on Mr. Bigler's post-Miranda silence were not harmless. Mr. Bigler was convicted and sentenced to death for the murders of Tommy and Kim Miller in their rural Howard County trailer on the night of December the 11th, 1981. The prosecution's case was built on two areas of evidence, Scotty Brooke and a quantity of circumstantial evidence. Scotty Brooke's story was that he was present when Bigler shot the Millers sometime around 11 o'clock the night of December the 11th, 1981. Brooke testified that he, Bigler, and Scotty Brooke's brother were drinking at a bar in Galveston, Indiana. Galveston, Indiana is in the adjacent county of Cass. At some point that night, they left to go pick up Mr. Bigler's girlfriend in Kokomo. Scotty Brooke claimed that Mr. Bigler took a detour and went to the Millers. Brooke claimed that he was reluctantly present when the Millers were killed that night. He said that Mr. Bigler suddenly stopped on the road in front that passed by the Millers, that Bigler got out, that Brooke got out, and grabbed Mr. Bigler trying to stop him. When Mr. Bigler broke away, Mr. Brooke claimed that he yelled at him. According to Scotty Brooke, he followed Mr. Bigler into the trailer. When he entered the trailer, he described it as dark and silent. Brooke claimed he heard no gunshots. He could see only shadows and blurs. But yet, he says he saw Marvin Bigler holding a gun. He said he saw no body, but he says he saw Marvin.
At one time, he said he did hear a gunshot.
Police?
Didn't he say at one time he did hear a gunshot?
I don't think he ever acknowledged hearing gunshots. The police, in their interrogations, I believe, tried to get him to say he heard gunshots, but he pretty consistently said he did not hear gunshots. He said he didn't hear see any bodies, but yet he says he saw Mr. Bigler pick up a garbage bag and carry it out of the trailer. When they got back out to the car, Mr. Brooks said he blacked out. However, he then remembers being in Kokomo at the place of employment of Marvin Bigler's girlfriend, Thelma McVeigh. He also remembers that Bigler took her home and that they then went to the Dolphin Bar in Kokomo. And then they returned a second time to Thelma McVeigh's house where Mr. Bigler left Mr. Brooke, and Mr. Brooke testified that he then was taken to his girlfriend's house in Kokomo. There were problems with Mr. Brooke's story. First and foremost, is several witnesses testified that the Millers were still alive after Brooke said Bigler had killed them. Francis Kidwell, who lived next door within 60 feet of the trailer, who was the Miller's landlord, testified that she went out, that she checked on the Miller's trailer three times that night. The first time was at 11 o'clock as the clock chimed 11. She actually went outside to her mailbox, looked over at the Miller's trailer because she was concerned that they had a dog in violation of their lease. She had heard a dog barking. She was kind of concerned. She looked over there. The lights in the living room were on. She then says, at 11:30, she checked again when she went in the kitchen to get cake. She looked out. The same lights were on. The third time was right before she went to bed. She testified she went to bed between 12 and 12:30. And again, the same lights were on. We also had the testimony of Tommy Miller's mother, Faye Nova. She had been there that night to pick up her grandson. She testified that after she left, it took 40 minutes to get back to Kokomo. She got back. At some point, she spoke on the phone with Tommy Miller. She testified unequivocally that she spoke with her son at 11:20. Now, it is significant that both Faye Nova and Ms. Kidwell both testified to the times based on looking at clocks. Ms. Kidwell said she had checked her watch several times that evening. And Ms. Kidwell had said that she had heard the clock chiming 11. We also have a bartender who says, the other problem with Mr. Brooks' story is how it came to light. When he was first arrested, he denied knowing anything about it, said he was not at the Millers. 2 weeks after being held in jail, he came forward and said, "I dreamed I was being there." Then, several months later, after he's convicted of possession of a sawed-off shotgun, he immediately comes forward to the police and tells them that he was there and now he remembers. And at that point, he got his deal.
You know, a lot of this sounds like closing argument to a jury, what you're telling us here. As far as this Doyle claim that you're making in this case, if what happened in Doyle is a 10 on the violation of due process rights to cross-examination, where do you put the questions that were asked here of Sigler?
I put this near Doyle. Like Doyle, I believe it's as long, in terms of the amount of transcript it covers, it is about the same amount of transcript as Doyle. What is interesting about the prosecutor's approach here is that he drew this out of Mr. Bigler, okay, that he had exercised his Miranda rights upon his arrest and had remained silent, knowing that. He drew that out. In Doyle, the prosecutor is more confrontational and says, "Why didn't you tell them of their innocence and so forth?" Okay. I think the prosecutor was fine. He did this at the very beginning of his cross-examination of Mr. Bigler. If you look at the...
Well, yeah, just asking, have you told this story that you're telling now to anyone else prior to taking the stand, that's not a violation of Doyle.
That's correct. And if it had stopped at that, we would probably not have it. We would not have a violation of Doyle, but it did not stop at that. He went to... You had an opportunity, didn't you? Yes. What did you do? I exercised my Miranda rights. He then doesn't drop the subject. He then says, "What are those Miranda rights? You actually know those before you were arrested too, didn't you?" And then he goes through those Miranda rights. Now, the other thing about this case compared to Doyle is that he returned to the subject of silence in his final argument. The prosecutor was using this to impeach Mr. Bigler. He told the jury... he had the opportunity to bring up silence because one of the other witnesses had exercised his Fifth Amendment right. Okay, the prosecutor reminded the jury or told the jury that you exercise your right to silence because you don't want to be convicted because you don't want to confess to something. Okay, he also talked about how Mr. Bigler never said anything.
I think you're right that the closing argument was more of a Doyle-type violation than the questioning of Bigler cross-examination. But in the big picture of what happened here and the Indiana court's analysis of the situation, how trouble about how we're going to find or supposed to find an unreasonable application of Doyle here.
Your Honor, it's our position that the facts here are indistinguishable from Doyle. In other words, when you look at the material facts of Doyle, the facts in Doyle were that the prosecutor cross-examined the defendant regarding and brought out him exercising his right to remain silent under Miranda. Okay? The facts were materially indistinguishable.
They really harped on it in Doyle. That was really harping on it in Doyle. Why didn't you claim you were framed immediately when the police arrested you.
Yes. As I said, as I was speaking before, I believe what the prosecutor was doing here was different in that it was not highly confrontational, but it also brought home to the jury, okay, he was trying to make sure the jury knew that Mr. Bigler, when he was arrested, remained silent.
Look,
when he was given an opportunity to tell his story, which is similar, which is very, almost identical to the facts in Doyle. Now, the other thing in terms of reasonableness is that the Indiana Supreme Court's finding is based upon what I consider unreasonable conclusions of fact or findings of fact or interpretations of the record.
Our problem here today is that we have to deal with the ADEPA standard, and we would have to find that we have an unreasonable application of the law to the facts. From my vantage point, there's no question that there was error and that there wasn't, I mean, I can't think of a legitimate use of his post-arrest silence, but the state court's finding that it was harmless and not unreasonable is something that would be very, very difficult to get past here.
Yes. Your Honor, in looking at the opinion, the decision, I believe, we submit that it's unclear whether they made a harmlessness finding. Because, in fact, they said there was no error. They said these facts did not parallel Doyle. They do mention the Tenth Circuit's opinion in Massey. However, they never mention whether they find this error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I think they say that the error, if there was error, was harmless.
Right. But as I said, they do not say it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But more importantly, Your Honor, they did not consider the probative force of the other evidence. They said there was other evidence indicative of guilt. But that's not the standard. The standard is, did this have an effect? Did this have an impact when you look at the record as a whole? The reason I started in regard to the facts, looking at those facts, is that when you objectively examine the whole record, the record as a whole, this was a very close case. The jury deliberated 13 hours. The star state's witness was very incredible, both because of the story he told, because it conflicted with other disinterested witnesses as to what was going on that night at the Miller's trailer. Moreover, the star witness didn't come forward until he got his deal. The other thing is that when you look at the circumstantial evidence, which the state Supreme Court cites as indicative of Mr. Bigler's guilt, is that it's just as reasonably to infer from that circumstantial evidence that Mr. Brook committed these crimes. He had motive. He was Mr. Bigler's partner in the marijuana business. He had made threats against Tommy Miller, and there was evidence that he had actually threatened Miller with a gun. He had opportunity. He went home to his girlfriend's house after leaving, after being taken from Ms. Confetti's house. Okay, he dyed his boots the very next morning. He had some story about wanting to change the color of them, but this is the very next morning. Moreover, he hid from police when they came to his girlfriend's house, and he denied being there when questioned initially. He denied knowing anything about it.
That all may be very true, but there is also some strong evidence that Bigler did it. Going to Florida, the casings that were found, 38. Although both people had access to that, I agree. But that's sort of a whodunit question for the jury to decide in the first instance.
Was there any fingerprint evidence on any of the coins that,
No, there is no physical or trace evidence that connects Mr. Bigler to this crime. Your Honor, to answer your question in regard to the, there is, admittedly, the circumstance, the evidence, if you can make reasonable inferences from it, but the Indiana, or I'm sorry, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it clear that you have to examine the probative force, okay? And when you look at circumstantial evidence, you look at how strong that inference from that circumstantial evidence is. Regarding the shell casings, Mr. Brooke shot the gun at the very same location. He considered this gun as a gun we carried, him and Marvin Bigler. So, in other words, when you look at that circumstantial evidence, this case was very even. And it's our position that the one distinguishing thing that the prosecutor brought forward to try to persuade the jury that it should believe Scotty Brooke instead of Marvin Bigler is that Marvin Bigler, when he was arrested and given his Miranda rights, he exercised those rights and remained silent.
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. We have the drop the dime thing, which is part of this, and other people other than Brooke said that Bigler had said that.
Yes, in regard to these coins that were in the bedroom. First of all, there were coins under Kim Miller's body, okay? What's the inference from that? That there were coins laying around there before anyone was shot. Secondly, Mr. Miller's brother discovered the bodies, okay, and made a mad rush to remove things from the trailer, okay? Now, we don't know, we know he removed bags of marijuana, but we don't know what else happened. We don't know, that coin, okay, was on the ironing board. Assuming Mr. Brooke is truthful, it's dark in there, okay? But we, as I said, we have coins under Kim Miller. So, as I said, the inference is that there were coins laying around in that bedroom before they were shot.
Now, I haven't read the transcript of this trial, but it was evidence that Bigler said, if I ever find out who was the informant here, who dropped the dime on me, I'm going to get him. Words of that effect. He denied that during his cross-examination. I know what the cross is about the Miranda stuff, but what did he say on that score?
I believe he acknowledged, and I'm not positive I'm correct on that, that he may have made, his relationship with the Millers, with Mr. Miller, I think he did deny that he made the specific threat. I think in regard to these threats, I think it's important to keep in mind that when you look at them closely, the persons who were testifying to these threats was Kathy Nutt, who was Bobby Nutt's wife, and Bobby Nutt was a suspect, okay? And Brooke testified to those things. Interestingly, Scotty Brooke, the night that he went to the Dolphin Bar bartender testified that he was making threats about informants, and specifically the bartender's brother-in-law and sister-in-law. And when you look at that record, he testifies that it's Scotty Brooke who is making threatening statements that very night at the Dolphin Bar, which is the last bar that he says he and Mr. Bigler were at, who is making threatening statements about informants. Some of the other witnesses, I think it's set forth in the brief, one of them attributed a threat to Mr. Bigler. Of course, he was also being threatened and with arrest. Another witness recanted her statement to police and said that it was actually Scotty Brooke who had made the threat against the Millers. So the bottom line is that these threats, the source of the evidence was coming from Kathy Nutt and Scotty Brooke. returning to the question of harmfulness in regard to the Indiana Supreme Court's holding and whether they're entitled, whether that limits this court's ability to grant relief, I would note that the court made no attempt to weigh the probative force of the other evidence. Secondly, the harmlessness standard is to consider whether it had an effect. This court, the Indiana Supreme Court, was saying that this was not even a Doyle violation, was not even a comment on Mr. Bigler's exercise of his Miranda right to remain silent. They also came up with this contextual thing where they said, well, the prosecutor was simply contrasting his position with that of Mr. Bigler because Mr. Bigler had not made a statement to police before the trial. That's unreasonable. We know under Brett that you look at the frequency of the unconstitutional comments. You look at whether there was evidence of pre-Miranda silence, and in this case there was none. In fact, Mr. Bigler had been asked whether he did this by several people, and he said, no, I did not do this.
You know, that brings something, another question that I had up, because the prosecutor complained that he had nothing to use to impeach Mr. Bigler because he made no statements prior to trial. But wouldn't that tend to bolster Mr. Bigler as much as it hurts him? In other words, the prosecutor is pointing out that Mr. Bigler has told only one story and has never told or said anything that's inconsistent. So how does that harm Mr. Bigler?
I think it harms Mr. Bigler because, in fact, it is, again, saying, what you recall, the prosecutor comments, and you knew your Miranda rights before you were even arrested, okay? And then he says, you took advantage of this, and I don't have any prior inconsistent statements because of that. That's the essence of his examination. I do not see that as bolstering Mr. Bigler's credibility because he doesn't, you know, there is no reference to it again about inconsistent statements until the final argument, and then the prosecutor again brings it up to note Mr. Bigler exercised his Miranda rights after he was arrested and remained silent. It's our position that there is no limit under 2254D to this court's authority to grant habeas relief because the Indiana Supreme Court, number one, failed to find error when these facts were materially indistinguishable from Doyle. And secondly, that they unreasonably applied Doyle by saying that when you look at this, the context of this, and you look at the other cross-exam, there is no error. Doyle doesn't say that you have to have three comments about silence to be error. It says you can make no comments. This court seemed to indicate that there wasn't enough here. The other thing is that in regard to the harmlessness finding, the court did not look at the probative force and weigh the probative force of the other evidence. And quite clearly, the U.S. Supreme Court says you have to consider that because it's not whether there's other evidence of guilt. It's whether or not this had a substantial and injurious effect on the jury's verdict. Here was a close case. We had a star witness for the state who was highly incredible, and we had circumstantial evidence where the inferences arising from equally implicated that star witness. And finally, we had what I would call unassailable evidence presented by the state themselves. Ms. Kidwell, Mr. Miller's own mother, who testified that Tommy Miller and his wife were still alive when Mr. Bigler was picking up his girlfriend in Kokomo. And under those circumstances, we believe that this error did meet Brecht. and was substantially injurious and had an effect on the jury's verdict. We would ask the court to grant the writ. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Creason?
May it please the court. The district court properly denied the writ in this case because the Indiana Supreme Court did not objectively, did not improperly reject the Doyle violation in an objectively unreasonable manner. Excuse me.
I'm going to ask you for something straight off the bat. What would you say is the best evidence against Spiegler other than Mr. Brooks' testimony? In other words, if we exclude the testimony that came in through Brooks, what would be the absolutely best evidence that Mr. Spiegler committed these murders?
All the other evidence, admittedly, is circumstantial. And I think my personal opinion is that it's the weight of all of the other evidence that corroborates Scotty Brooks' testimony. And that would include the fact, primarily, that defendant told many people that he was going to blow away the Millers for dropping a dime on him. Dropping a dime being ratting him out.
Can you say the Millers are the person who ratted him out?
He suspected Tommy Miller being the person who ratted him out.
Did he name Miller, or did he say, if I find out who did it, I'm going to get him? Words of that effect.
I believe he said both to different people.
He did say he's going to get the Millers.
That's my recollection, yes, Sean. I don't have a record site, however, to point you to specific persons. You said that.
But don't we have Brooks saying basically the same thing?
Well, I don't believe, the state does not believe it's the same sort of threats. They're similar, yes. And you have to also couple in there the fact that defendant ran to Florida, and he knew that he was wanted for the Beagler murders, for the Miller murders. He admits that in his testimony, and yet he didn't make any effort whatsoever. In fact, he stayed in Florida and tried to hide more, expected them to eventually catch up with him. That is also very probative of evidence of his guilt. The fact that Scotty Brook, for lack of a better term, made furtive attempts to avoid police, he was there. He was, so far as he knew, he was just as much a suspect and an accomplice at the very minimum as Beagler, could suffer the same penalty because of his involvement. He didn't know what the police had on him. So the fact that Scotty Brook was not willing to really give great, was not willing to cooperate with police from the get-go should not be surprising in the least. Mr. Beagler asks this court to reweigh the evidence in his favor anew. That is not a proper exercise of this court's authority. Instead, this court should look under the Brecht standard to determine whether there was a substantial and injurious effect or influence in the jury's verdict. In other words, the state believes that Brecht requires that any Doyle violation be the linchpin. It's what the jury had to fall back on. Respectfully, that cannot be in this case. The Indiana Supreme Court used the 5-point harmless beyond a reasonable doubt test that the Tenth Circuit used, a lesser standard than what Mr. Beagler has to meet for this court to grant the writ. And among those are the intensity and frequency of the reference. In Brecht, it was about 2 pages of only 900 pages of transcript. Here we have over 3 times that amount of transcript and record. And yet it really only takes about 2 pages of references. They were brief. I'd like to point out that the prosecutor's comment when he started was, have you had the opportunity to tell anybody your version of events? Not, did you have the opportunity to tell police about your events? Mr. Beigler is the one who asserted the police reference and started in on the Miranda. Then the prosecutor, for lack of a better term, was in a pickle. And he faced the problem of the Doyle violation and attempted to cure it, perhaps.
Now, wasn't he in a pickle because of the ineffectiveness of counsel in not objecting to the whole line of questioning?
Respectfully, I don't see how counsel could have objected. The question, did you have the opportunity to tell anybody, is not objectionable.
No, but then we go forward.
Well, once Mr. Beigler asserted the Miranda issue into it all, and he injected the problem himself, so it's, if anything, invited error once on the part of trial counsel. Trial counsel could have handled this better, and the prosecutor could have handled it better. Probably the better thing to have done would have been to told the trial judge, I see a potential problem here, Your Honor.
Sidebar.
Let's excuse the jury. Let's deal with this. Let's have some sort of curative instruction. That did not happen. Instead, the prosecutor backtracked and said, you knew about your rights. You didn't have to, what are those rights, he said. In that is, you don't have to talk to police if you don't want to. That line of questioning admits, the state believes, is the state's admission that you didn't have to talk to police. And then he moved on quickly.
I'd really like to talk a little bit about Mr. Beigler's lawyer. The one certainly seems to have seriously misunderstood the legal standards for mitigation. He seemed to have thought that his client's life experiences were irrelevant, and so he didn't bother to investigate Beigler's life thoroughly. And I, for one, find this legal error troubling. How do you think a legal error by counsel ought affect our review at this stage? Because you didn't address counsel's misapprehension of the law on mitigation in your brief. Or if you did, I missed it.
I don't believe I addressed it squarely, and that's because of the way that the state views the representation in total. If you read the post-conviction transcript of Mr. Scruggs' testimony at the post-conviction hearing in a deposition, it's a substantial number of pages. That's on the post-conviction record, pages 5338 through 85 and 5423 through 41. And one of those pages is a big deposition transcript.
Right.
But he did understand what mitigation evidence was. He realized that he had to explain a reason to spare Mr. Beigler's life in light of the jury having convicted him of brutal murders for his own pecuniary gain, really.
What I'm saying is that he failed to conduct any work on mitigation at all until after the guilty verdict came in. And at that point, he seemed to have given up on his client, who he thought was a bad person. He didn't even question his witnesses before he put them on the stand. And then he has this disastrous testimony from the friend who sold the murder weapon. And here's my worry. If we rule that this is effective representation what would remain of the standard? I mean, no one would want that kind of representation if they were on trial for their life. I mean,
respectfully, Your Honor, that reading of the testimony is in the light most favorable to Mr. Beigler's arguments now. If you read Mr. Scruggs' testimony, he believed that Beigler did not commit these crimes. But also in there is the fact that Beigler, frankly, is not a nice man. He's a drug dealer. He's a drug runner. The jury disliked him under his reading of the jury. And part and parcel from that is the fact he tried to make a connection, difficult as it was, to say, before Vietnam, Beigler was a different man. My client was a nice man. After Vietnam, the Marines trained him into a killer, and they sent him to a horrible place. And Mr. Beigler's was interviewed by Dr. Dooley, who was the expert. And to the extent that counsel and the expert misunderstood his Vietnam record, which the state submits he did not, when you read Dr. Dooley's testimony, he said that he had combat experience, but that most of his work was non-combat work, but that he saw some very gruesome things. Nevertheless, that all came from Beigler himself in his interview. Beigler misrepresented his Vietnam experience to the extent it was misrepresented. But then he comes back from Vietnam, he starts his drug use.
Didn't counsel fail to ask the proper questions regarding, I mean, the psychiatrist was present, and he would have testified to Beigler's post-traumatic stress disorder, but counsel failed to ask the right questions. I mean, how do you reconcile the trial court's emphasis on the lack of evidence on Vietnam syndrome with the harmless error standard? Do you see what I'm getting at?
I'm not entirely sure.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Counsel just didn't ask the right questions.
Counsel didn't want those questions answered for a strategic reason. Having a diagnosis of and there's a number of parts here, if I can tie it all together. Post-traumatic stress, this is 1983. This is even before Strickland was decided. The death penalty in Indiana was 5 years old at that point, maybe six. 1977 at some point in time was when it was. And the crimes were committed in 81, the same year the post-traumatic stress disorder was recognized by the American Psychiatric Association and put in the DSM. But it was a very controversial decision. In fact, it remains controversial to this day. Counsel didn't want to say, he wanted to maintain his client's innocence. He didn't, and not offer any excuses for the crime. Now, the state recognizes that mitigation case law, which has been developed since this trial, points out that mitigation isn't excuses, it's a reason to spare someone's life. Counsel Scruggs understood that. He wanted to give reasons and not excuses. He believed that the jury would view post-traumatic stress disorder, something they probably had never heard of, as an excuse. I had it rough in Vietnam, and that's why I killed these people. He wanted to walk a line with Dr. Dooley's testimony, offer reasons that, look, this is a serious thing. The Vietnam stress disorder, the personality disorder, it affects a lot of people. And Mr. Beigler has had experiences that it seems that it would affect him too, but didn't want to say, and he has post-traumatic stress disorder, which is, you know, on this axis in the DSM and all of that. It alienates the jury. The jury wasn't getting anywhere. That is, Counsel Scruggs was trying to do his best with his client. He was handed his client, and he can't make his client into someone who he is not. And Counsel Scruggs was a very experienced defense attorney. He had tried 40 to 50 murder cases, had been an assistant United States attorney, was well respected. In fact, he was sought out by that lead counsel at the time, the original.
This was his first death case, of course.
Yes, but there were only a handful of death cases ever tried in the United States, or excuse me, in Indiana, and probably the United States, at least under the current regime of mitigation evidence before before Jerk v. Texas and Gregg v. Georgia, mitigation didn't exist. This was a new body of case law, trying to do his best. And the state believes did a good job of that with what he had. He tried to paint Mr. Beagler into someone other than the cold-hearted drug-dealing killer that the state had portrayed him as. The jury believed the state's evidence. And, you know, while Mr. Beagler laments that fact respectfully, there is no deficient performance here, and there's no evidence that the trial court, not the jury, but the trial court, as sentencer, would have given defendant anything other than a death sentence if a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder had been made, instead of explaining the bulk of that. And, you know, touting out someone's long history in Vietnam, after a while, starts to sound like you're making excuses.
See, what has kept me awake was that the trial court said that the only real evidence in mitigation was an attempt to show that he was suffering from Vietnam syndrome, but that the evidence was lacking. And for me, that says that the trial court might have sentenced Beagler differently if his lawyer had worked it differently, had asked the right questions.
The state, respectfully, Your Honor, views that sort of statement differently. He couldn't find it to be anything more than what it was. Not that he would have given it more greater weight than the aggravating circumstances that were presented, which were in the fairly high range.
Mr. Cleason, I'd like to ask you something. Under the state's theory, what time were the Millers killed?
That is a difficult question for me as an attorney on habeas review, not knowing all of the evidence that was even that was not presented as to what it was. But sometime in between, I believe it's 10 and 1, and they believed it was closer to, I believe, 11 o'clock or thereafter, because mainly because there were witnesses that said that, you know, Beagler was there and the bad weather and whatsoever. Of course, Beagler's alibi is, all alibis are self-serving, but this one is particularly self-serving. All of the witnesses are interested. They're not disinterested witnesses. They're his friends, his family. And not giving an alibi and sending someone, their friend or family member, to death row would not be something which I'm sure that they would like to do. And so we believe that they had reason to fabricate, just as Mr. Beagler had reason to fabricate his story after seeing, of course, all the evidence.
Well,
this isn't to say that comment on his post-Miranda silence is proper. It is not.
Well, and it also sort of takes us back to the ineffectiveness of the lawyer, because his lawyer was obliged to go to the places where he claimed to have been that night to see if anyone saw him. Instead, the lawyer relied on a police report. And the police, after all, are not going to try to prove Mr. Beagler's innocence. They're trying to prove his guilt. They're not going to go looking for exculpatory witnesses. Defense counsel has to do that himself. I find it amazing, for instance, that he couldn't find out who, you know, Mr. Beagler's girlfriend, you know, was. It seems to me that a reasonably diligent lawyer would have found her before trial, and instead it was simply luck, you know, that brought her testimony to light in the post-trial proceedings.
I believe you're referring to Lynn McGaha,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Ms. McGaha.
That is not Mr. Beagler's girlfriend. It's a friend, a co-worker and a friend of the girlfriend.
I'm sorry. Right.
2 points. First of all, is that there's no, Ms. McGaha is not a disinterested witness. She was a friend. And if the police and FBI, she hid her testimony from the police and FBI, super counsel could not drag things out of people who don't want to give any. The Constitution does not require more thorough investigation than the FBI can deliver and that the local police can deliver. It requires reasonably competent examination. Ms. McGaha is the only person who offers any sort of additional evidence on the alibi through the post-conviction proceedings. In other words, she was it that counsel didn't know about. And her testimony is just as suspect as the others, and in fact more suspect, because she claims that she has a perfect memory of that night 12 years or more than 12 years after the fact, and suddenly discovers it. That's highly suspect, Your Honor. She didn't come forward at the time. She's a friend of Teresa McVetti. This is not the sort of person that counsel wants to discover when he has more. I mean, I guess at most she would have been more of what was already presented. She's really no different than the others and was highly uncredible in the state's belief. So therefore there was no deficient performance. Beagler cannot show anything that his counsel should have done that he didn't think about or that he didn't understand or that he didn't try to do given his claim and the situation he's presented. If there are no further questions, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the denial of the writ of habeas corpus.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Westfield, how much time? You have 5 minutes, Mr. Westfield.
First of all, regarding the comments, the threats, the specific threat, blow away Mr. Miller. Examination of the record reveals that those words came from, or the evidence of that came from Kathy Nutt and Bobby Nutt only. Okay, in other words, Bobby Nutt, a suspect, Kathy Nutt, his wife. Secondly, I heard the prosecutor suggest that this was invited error. This has never been raised at any point in time. An examination of the state's brief in the direct appeal shows that they addressed all these claims on the merits and did not at any point say this was invited error. Regarding this question of the attorney's performance in preparing for this case, long before Strickland, the duty, the fundamental duty of a defense attorney in a criminal case was to conduct an independent investigation. An independent investigation means that you go out and look for witnesses to support your client's defense. The trial attorney testified he read the police reports. He did not go to syndicate sales and interview any witnesses. He didn't send somebody over there to interview them. Ms. McGaha did not know Mr. Bigler before she testified in the post-conviction hearing. This supposition that the FBI combed and talked to everybody at syndicate sales, there is no evidence of that. Furthermore, Your Honor, you ask about they make this position that this alibi evidence, or the where Mr. Bigler was by 11:15 the night of December the 11th of 1981, the state says all these were friends of and interested witnesses for the defense. Kathy Nutt worked at Syndicate Sales. She was the state's witness. The state relied upon her. She testified that she saw Thelma McVetti getting ready and leaving work around 11:15, 11:20, and that Thelma McVetti said, "They're here," meaning Marvin Bigler, to pick her up. We also have a business record as to when she clocked out, 11:02. There was consistent testimony that she was gone from her place of employment by 11:20, 11:15. Now, the state suggests that the killing, now they're suggesting that it could have occurred at 1 o'clock. Scotty Brook testified himself that it was that he was at the Dolphin bar by 11:30. And when you look at the distance, it's impossible for Mr. Bigler to drive from the Miller's home all the way to Syndicate Sales and the Dolphin bar by 11:30. Tommy Miller's mother testified at the trial it took her 40 minutes to get from her son's trailer that night to her home. Okay? What the state fails to in any way acknowledge is that their witness, who had no interest in this case, who was just the landlord of the Millers, who had an interest in watching the Millers trailer, said that the living room lights are on between 12 and 12:30. It just simply does not add up. It does not add up. And we have Tommy Miller's own mother saying, I spoke to him at 11:20. Your Honor, in regard to the trial counsel and his view of his obligation and what he did for Mr. Bigler in regard to the penalty case, he only looked at a military record that the prosecutor had obtained. He did no independent investigation into Mr. Bigler's service in Vietnam. And his service in Vietnam was a highly mitigating factor. Moreover, the state contends that because that the trial counsel did not want to present evidence that Mr. Bigler had PTSD, why put the psychologist on to testify about all of these characteristics? In fact, trial counsel did not understand the law of mitigation, and he had a duty to understand that. He did not understand his duty and obligation to investigate for the penalty phase. He did nothing until the trial had occurred. Most of the excuses that the state brings up are things that he discovered once Marvin Bigler testified. He had an obligation to do something well before that point in time. We would ask the court to grant the writ. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. And the case will be taken under advisement, and the court is in recess until the next sitting.